Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the abuse excuse when we come back. And let me ask you this, what do you think is wrong with the Ten Commandments? Because it's pretty obvious that something is wrong with the Ten Commandments because they've been banned from our public schools, banned from our public institutions, and banned from our national consciousness. Now, instead of these 10 simple, time-tested laws, we see the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. And they're teaching these 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in our schools, public institutions, and we've made them a part of our national psyche. Now, you know, this is a pretty radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years, wouldn't you say? And are you aware that your daughter, for instance, couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but your daughter can have an abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent? That's why I contend that the solution to this kind of moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. Our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments, and they even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there's still one school left in America that teaches this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties and the 33 benefits that we all receive for their observance. Now, you know, every law has a penalty, and you don't have to know what the penalty to a law is to suffer from its effect. So whether you call this the Mosaic Law, the Law of God, the Common Law, the Natural Law, Karma, or something else, it's automatic, and it works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happen to be the natural penalties for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package? You know, that's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about the abuse excuse written by Alan Dershowitz. Dershowitz, remember now, is a college professor, law school professor at Harvard. He's also a practicing attorney, practices before the Supreme Court of the United States, done a number of high-profile cases. A flaming radical liberal, college professor, but that doesn't make him dumb. It's I think he's got a pretty sharp mind, and he has raised a lot of good, logical questions that need debate and dialogue and a little serious thought. So I thought I'd share that with you. He wrote a book, and it's called The Abuse Excuse and Other Cop-Outs, Sob Stories, and Evasions of Responsibility, and I especially like that evasion of responsibility. And that's a hallmark of American society or American everyday garden variety lifestyle today is just total irresponsibility. We're irresponsible when it comes to money, jobs, child rearing, law and order. I mean, you just name it, and we're on a party. We've been on a big party here since the end of World War II, and I would contend we've taken total leave of our senses. And this book, I think, is a good step in the right direction, called The Abuse Excuse by Alan Dershowitz. I ranked it a 1 in 100 read. I don't think you're going to find another book out there like it's very, very unique, and I'd try to describe unique with an adjective, but that unique is supposed to tell the story. Now, he brings an article to our attention here called Three Strikes is No Answer for Crime. Some years ago in California, they came up with a new concept. It's called Three Strikes and You're Out. California is our largest state. It has about 30 million people, and it's also number one in everything. I mean, it's number one in crime, and number one in debt, number one in perversion, and number one, you name it, and California is number one in everything. And if they're not, they're running a close second. And if they're in third place, I don't know about it. And they came up with an idea, and they said, well, what we need to do here is deal with crime like this. Once, twice, third time you're out, we're going to sentence you to life in prison. And there was an interesting case came up. There was a guy that had two convictions. I don't know what for now exactly, but they weren't anything great. Probably a couple felonies, but theft primarily. The guy's a thief. Anyway, he stole a $110 bicycle, third time, $110 bicycle. And so they found him guilty, and then they sentenced him to life in prison for stealing this third time, this $110 bike. Now, if you look in the Bible for a corollary to this, the penalty for this third strike in the Bible would have been the death penalty. Death, D-E-A-T-H, we just kill him. bring him up in the second resurrection and deal with him then. Now, this third strike in your out program over here is a pretty expensive, a pretty serious step. I think I'll describe it for you again, because it costs about $50,000 a year to store this guy in prison. I don't know how old this guy is, but if you're stealing a bicycle, I would assume you're younger than 65 or 70. I mean, I'm an old man. If I was going to steal something, it wouldn't be a bicycle. My guess is this guy's in his 20s, maybe 30s, and now he's been sentenced to life in prison. This guy never stole $50,000 total. I mean, he's been convicted for $50,000 worth of theft. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt. Let's suppose that he stole a couple of cars worth $25,000, and then he stole a $110 bicycle. So he's got $50,000 worth of theft, and the guy's 30 years old. Well, he's going to live for another 45 years, so statistically. Now, 45 years times $50,000 a year. You Californians sentenced yourselves to a $50,000 fine per year times 45 years for a total of $2,250,000. You people in California are going to pay $2,250,000 for law and order. Wouldn't it be easier to just kill this guy and get it over with? And let me bring up the subject of cruel and unusual punishment. Honest to God, do you people out there believe that by locking a human being up in a cage for the rest of his life is humane? Hell, you don't even do that to wild animals. You know, it used to be when we caught a gorilla over in the jungles of Africa and brought him to the United States, we'd lock him up like King Kong, remember, in a jail cell, a barred room, a cage with bars on it, and then we'd come by and gawk at him, see? We did that to monkeys. I remember as a child, they used to have a cage out at the Sequoia Park Zoo in Eureka, California. God, that was exciting. We could go out there and watch these monkeys. They'd run around this cage, and they had bars and swings and trees, you know, little stub trees in there they could run around and jump up and down. And that's what they were doing, and it was very entertaining, you know, when you're 4, 5, 6, 7 years old. That's quite a little treat. So anyway, the moral to the story is we had them caged up. Now, it's against the law to cage these animals up. You can't take a gorilla and cage him up. You've got to put him in a natural environment. And so now the zoos have created a kind of a little park-like area. And then they've got an inside area, and, you know, they can go inside out of the sun, and they can climb around on trees, and they've got grass and, you know, kind of a natural, something simulates the jungle, their natural environment. Well, they're locked up. They can't escape. They can't get away. But we don't lock them up in a cage. Now, in prison, we don't put people out in a natural environment, you know, like a mall, and then lock them up in this mall and let them walk around in the mall and go shopping and do stuff. We lock them up in a cage for the rest of their lives. And we do this. We call it a penitentiary, so they can do penance. And the theory behind it was that when these guys get through doing their penance, they'll come out and they won't do this again, so, which is totally false. Hell, it's up around 70%. They call it 70%. They call it recidivism. And how many of these guys are going to go out and commit crimes again? 70%. So they came up with this solution here that, well, we're going to make this so bad. We're going to scare you people so bad. Third time, third strike, and you're out. So the real victim in this case is the taxpayer, but it's not done by accident. The politicians and the sociologists and psychiatrists and the people who were pushing for this law persuaded the taxpayers in this case hey, listen, we got to do something about crime, and let's get tough on crime. And so let's lock these guys up in prison. See, here's the problem. If you kill this guy, you solve the problem. You don't need any guards. You don't need any construction permits to build new prisons. You don't need any new prisons out here. The guy's dead, and that's the end of the argument. And it's a hell of a lot more humane. He'll come up in the second resurrection, and he can go deal with God, or God can deal with him. But you're not going to lock this guy up for 30, 40, 50 years, you know, in a cage, hoping that this guy's going to do penance. And what the hell difference does it make if he repents of his sin, of his crime, and he does penance? You're never going to let him out anyway. No matter what this guy does, he has absolutely nothing to look forward to. Now, you lock these people up in prison, and they've got a prison there in California. It's called Pelican something or other. It's Pelican Prison, Corcoran or Pelican Island or something. And they got the worst of the worst in there. I mean, these guys are killers. And they only let them out of their cells an hour a day. I mean, they lock these guys up, and these guys are just violent beyond description. And what in the hell would you expect? I mean, you lock this animal up in a cage, and he just reverts to his status as an animal. They try to kill prison guards and try to kill each other, and they're just kind of wild men locked up in cages. Now, there's nothing in the Bible that prescribes locking people up in cages, and in fact, our Seventh Amendment to our federal Constitution prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. But, of course, cruel and unusual is what we decided it is. It's kind of like torture. We just decide that, well, waterboarding is not torture. What do you call that? What would you call torture? Could you tell me what torture is? Could you give me some examples of torture so that I would know what to avoid? Now, locking people up is torture. And it's cruel and unusual. Waterboarding. sticking splinters under people's fingernails, causing pain. That's torture. What would you think if I took a snake, put him in a coffee can, poured a little gasoline on there, and threw a match in, a lit match? What would you think of that? Would you think that was cruel? What if I took a cat and hung it by its tail and let it starve to death, hanging by its tail? Would you think that was cruel and unusual? I mean, if I did something like that to an animal, you would want to kill me. You'd want to punish me. You'd want to really do something bad, wicked, terrible, awful, and evil. We do that to human beings, and we don't think anything about it. We call that penance, penitentiary. We call that three strikes and you're out. We send them off to Guantanamo, and you say, well, those are bad people. Hell, I don't doubt it. You know, there's bad snakes out there, like cobras. You know, they're bad snakes, but I don't think that I'd put him in a coffee can and burn him alive. I think I'd kill it, but I don't think I'd torture it. And yet, that's what we do to human beings. Now I want to bring that to your attention. That's not Alan Dershowitz. That's me. And Dershowitz comes along and he writes this article. It's on page 113 on three strikes is no answer for crime. I think the guy's right. I don't like crime any more than anybody else. But you know, if you're going to deal with crime, you should take a look at the results that you get. Is this practice getting the desired results that we all want? And if it isn't getting those results, don't you think we ought to change it? And then the question arises, well, change it to what? So I wanted to point out to you that in the Bible, there is a complete regime for dealing with crime and punishment. I mean, from A to Z, soup to nuts, the whole story is right there. It tells you exactly how to do it. We don't do it that way, and that's because this God of the Bible, the God of creation, is a sadistic maniac who came up with capital punishment and a whole bunch of punishments for crimes, and he's not kind and gentle, you know, like George Bush is kinder and gentler. Okay, now this guy didn't like that. And because of that, we had to fix his mistakes. His sense of justice and his modality for dealing with crime and punishment was just totally unsatisfactory to we human beings. And so we created a criminal justice system of our own. And we did that in California and Rhode Island and in Massachusetts. And Alan Dershowitz here is writing little short vignettes, little articles, describing the abuses that are coming out of that criminal justice system. Here's one of them. Now, here comes Alan Dershowitz. He says, when President Clinton in the State of the Union message led the chorus of politicians who favor a three strikes and you're out approach to crime, he characterized the plan as both tough and smart. Well, it's neither. It is bumper sticker criminology that will actually increase crime while wasting the taxpayers' millions of dollars. Let me repeat that. Dershowitz says, it is neither tough nor smart. I'll underline that. He says, it is a bumper sticker criminology that will actually increase crime while wasting the taxpayers' millions of dollars. All right, let's pause here for a moment and think about that. Has it ever occurred to anybody that the purpose behind the criminology system or the crime and punishment system of the United States is to increase crime and to waste your money? Have you ever thought about that? All right, well, let me explain to you how it is. Do you know that crime grows every year in America? It's been growing and growing and growing. In 1900, we had crime, but compared to 2000, that's 100 years later, and you compare that with crime in 1900, it was nothing by comparison. So we have more crime and more criminals. We have more people in jail here in the United States of America per capita. More people in jail per capita than anybody else in the world, including Red China and Russia. Isn't that just special? Why is that? America, the land of the free, the home of the brave? You know, the place where everybody in the world wants to come. Why is it that it is so crime-ridden? Do you suppose maybe the crime that we have in America is a policy decision that it's created? This lawyer, now, Alan Dershowitz, says this three strikes and you're out approach isn't tough, it isn't smart, it will increase crime, and it will waste your money. And he's exactly right. It does all of the above. But has it ever occurred to Mr. Dershowitz or you or me or anybody else that this policy is being followed intentionally for the express purpose of growing crime, because crime is a growth industry which benefits millions of people and puts a lot of money in their pockets, and that's why they're promoting it? Has anybody ever thought about that? All right, let me pause right here so I don't put any words in Mr. Dershowitz's mouth. Now, somebody may report me to Alan Dershowitz, and he may actually listen to one of these programs and say, well, I didn't say that. That Gordon's putting words in my mouth, and I don't want to do that. When I was in Boise, Idaho, this very question came up in crime and criminology, and so we had a police chief there. His name was Jim Montgomery, and Jim Montgomery, the police chief, nice guy, great guy. I'm not complaining about Police Chief Montgomery, but, you know, he was a protection man. a policeman, remember I mentioned last program, he runs a protection racket. And there were 168 policemen at that time in Boise, Idaho. And they're all part and parcel with an enforcement of a protection racket. And I showed you the other day, I said that, you know, if the mafia does that, we call that extortion. When the government does that, we call it law and order. Well, Chief Montgomery now is an extortionist. But they have a different modality for their extortion. They're not crass. They're not crude. They're not direct. They are very sophisticated, indirect, secretive. You never knew what happened to you. When the mafia guy comes into your store, you know, he speaks in his New York City accent, and he says, hey, chewing a little gum, he says, hey, listen, are you concerned about your store burning down, like that delicatessen up the street or like the clothing store down the street? He said, listen, your store will not burn down if you pay $100 every Wednesday, and I'll come and pick it up. And right away you say to yourself, my God, this guy's a mafia extortion racketeer. And you're probably right. But he's pretty direct and to the point. And he says, now listen, you pay me $100, then your store won't burn down. If you don't pay me $100, your store is going to burn down, I guarantee it. See how direct that is? Your store will burn down and I'll guarantee it. Just like that store up the street and the one down the street. So you pay him $100. Okay, now, the police chief, he's a little different. He doesn't come into you and say, you've got to pay these taxes or you've got to pay this, that, or something else. And if you don't, we're going to have a SWAT team come in here and raid you now or something like that. No, they're a lot smarter than that, a lot more sophisticated. The chief of police goes into the city council and gives a report. And he says, last year crime increased by 5% over the year before. And then he gives the statistics and the breakdown, and they've got statisticians, and they give you all the gory facts and figures. And then the police chief comes up with a remedy. He says, now I suggest that we come up with a remedy. And to help the police to combat crime, we need these enactments. We need these new laws. And so he presents these new laws that he's proposing to the city council. Okay. Then he says, now I need more money. To combat crime, I need a bigger budget. My budget last year was $1 million, so I need a 5% increase. So I need $1,050,000 for this coming year. I need a 5% increase in money. I need a 5% increase in police staff. I need to increase the number of police officers that we have from 168 to, five more, you know. So I got to have, another 8 cops, round numbers. And I got to have 8 more police cars. So I need an appropriation for police cars, an appropriation for more. That's what President Clinton did. See, remember back in the 90s, he said, we need to put 100,000 more cops on the streets of America. He's just doing a little bit. He's doing it at the federal level, you know. So he goes into Congress, you know, like the chief of police, and he says, we need 100,000 more cops, and then we need so much more money to pay their salaries and so many more new laws and so on. All right. So the city council says, well, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good proposal. I mean, who in the hell is going to be against the chief of police saying, I need more money to combat crime, which grew by 5% last year? I mean, that's like saying I'm in favor of rape. I'm in favor of child molestation. I'm in favor of torturing animals. I mean, nobody is going to be against combating crime. And so the city council enacts the chief of police's proposals, or at least most of them. And so the chief of police now gets 5% more money, 5% more cops, 5% more laws, 5% more of everything that he asks for. And what happens the following year when he comes into the city council? He reports that crime grew by 5%. Unless they have a bumper year and it grew by 6 or 7%. That happens sometimes. Why did crime grow by 5% after he got 5% more money, 5% more laws, and 5% more policemen? Well, because if you got 5% more laws to enforce and 5% more policemen to enforce them, crime is going to go up by 5% because those 5 policemen or those 5% more policemen are going to go out and find 5% more crime. You see, boys and girls, in 1900, it wasn't against the law for you to drive a car without a driver's license. Today it is. In 1900, it wasn't against the law for you to drive your car without wearing your seatbelt. That's because the car didn't have any seatbelts in it. In 1900, nobody cared whether you had an automatic or a semi-automatic or a Thompson submachine gun. It's irrelevant. Today, there are laws against that. And every time you enact a new law, you create a new series of crimes for which you and I and any and everybody else is going to break that law. And if you and I don't break it, then somebody else is. And when you get a sufficient number of people breaking a particular law, the law of averages says that one of those 5 extra cops, 5% more cops, is going to see that and arrest that guy, and crime is going to grow by 5%. If you want crime to grow by 10% a year, then you put in 10% more laws, 10% more police, and give them a 10% raise, and they'll grow by 10%. If you don't want crime to grow at 5%, then you only want to hold it at 2 or 2.5%. Increase the police chief's budget by 2 or 2.5%, give him 2 and 2.5% more laws, 2 or 2.5% more police, and then crime will only grow by 2.5%. You can have all of the crime that you want to buy and pay for. And that's what we Americans are buying and paying for. We are buying about 5% more crime every year because that's what we are programmed for. And that's a very lucrative business. I call it the law enforcement growth industry. Now, in order to create more criminals, in order to put more people behind bars for longer periods of time so that we can justify, this is what I call the Holiday Inn syndrome. See, Holiday Inn builds a hotel, and then they put a manager in there. They got 100 rooms in the hotel. If they rent out 50 rooms, then they have a 50% occupancy rate, so their vacancy rate is running 50%. So they want to cure their vacancy rate, so they have to get more people in. So they lower their prices and increase their advertisement, and pretty soon they're renting 75 rooms out of 100. Now their occupancy rate is 75%, and their vacancy rate is 25%. And the higher their occupancy rate, the more money they're making. Can you understand that? A Holiday Inn that has a 50% vacancy rate isn't making as much profit as a Holiday Inn that has a 25% vacancy rate. Now, if they can get the vacancy rate down to 5%, 4%, 3%, 2%, or eliminate it altogether and rent every room every night, then it's more profitable. Well, what do you think about your local jail? The local jail has a vacancy rate, and the local jail has to be filled up with customers to support public defenders and prosecuting attorneys and policemen and jailers and prison builders and construction companies. We need more jails so that we can support more construction and more construction companies and support more guards and collect more taxes from you, the people who want to buy more law and order. Now, isn't that just real special? Now, while you're mulling that one over, let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Now, be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. In the Law Hour, an editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors and publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Now, keep in mind, most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic. They can be sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans with an axe to grind, whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, now we're talking about Alan Dershowitz's book, of which I can only cover. I think I've covered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I've covered about one a day here in this series, about 7 topics. I'm going to guess that there's 100. It's a 300-page book, and there's about 3 pages for each one of these stories. So I'm going to guess that there's about 100 of these stories in here, which I've covered about 7. I selected 7 that caught my eye, caught my interest. But he's got many, many more. And I think that his logic, his reasoning is unsurpassed. Even in these areas where I disagree, you know, like capital punishment, his logic and his reasoning to come to the conclusion that he came to is impeccable. I can't find any fault with his logic. I just find fault with his conclusion because he believes, evidently like everybody else, that the God, the creator of the universe, is some kind of a barbarian and doesn't know what the hell he's doing when it comes to crime and punishment. I just take the opposite view. I think that the creator of the universe is a pretty smart guy. Generally speaking, people that are great with accomplishment are pretty smart, sound, level-headed people. And this God over here, you know, who's pretty competent guy. He's quite an astronomer. I mean, this guy can build solar systems, quasars, black holes, suns, planets, moons. And he calls the heavens his property. The heavens are my throne and the earth is my footstool. And he invented human beings and animals and plants. And he's a pretty smart guy. And he's also got a program in here to deal with crime and punishment. He doesn't believe in three strikes and you're out either. He's got a different program when it deals with crime and punishment. I pointed that out to you the other day. This guy's got 29 different ways of dealing with people, 29 different punishments. And he's got 24 crimes that he wants to use capital punishment, not just one or two, 24. 24 categories of crimes. You do this, and here's what we're going to do to you. We'll kill you. Now, Dershowitz comes up, and he says here on page 113, he says, I'm opposed to this three strikes. He said, now remember, it's not tough and smart, and it's going to increase crime, and it's going to waste taxpayers millions of dollars. And he's right. It does that, and I just told you why it does that, and it's done on purpose. Now, Dershowitz goes on. Here's what he said. He says, the main impact of mandating life sentences for all three-time losers will be to raise the average age of our prison population, since all three-time losers must remain in prison until they die. And since the average life expectancy of prisoners actually exceeds that for non-prisoners, we can expect to have to provide expensive prison cells for many 60, 70, and 80-year-old criminals, and every prison cell occupied by an octogenarian is a cell that is not available for the confinement of a 20-year-old, no matter how many new prisons we build. An enormous expense to the taxpayers. Yeah, $2.5 million. But listen, while that's an expense to you, the taxpayer, it's a benefit to the prison guard and the construction company that's building the prison, and to the politicians and the police and prosecutors and secretaries for prosecutors and public defenders and the whole law enforcement growth industry. Can you understand that? I mean, come on, grow up, smell the coffee, wake up. There will never be enough room for all of the violent offenders. Cases involving younger offenders will have to be plea bargained because the cells that would otherwise be available will be occupied by aging three-time losers. And so, let me interject this. In California, you have one prison cell occupied by a guy who stole three times. The last time he stole something was $110. Listen, if you wanted to do yourself a favor, you give him the bicycle and tell him, get the hell out of here, and it'll save you $50,000 a year. Taxpayers? I mean, he only stole $100. For crying out loud, wake up. The problem with this approach is that old criminals, even three-time losers, are for the most part less violent than the younger ones. This guy isn't convicted now for any violent crime. The guy I'm telling you about that stole that $110 bicycle, his last crime, isn't violent. He's just a thief. Ah, but he occupies a bed in the prison that costs $50,000 a year, or $2.5 million, or $2.25 million for the balance of his life. Does this make economic sense to you? Dershowitz says that it's nonsense. God, I can't agree with him more. Dershowitz goes a step further. He's coming up with the logical step-by-step sequence of events. My conclusion is very simple. I just don't want to spend the money to lock a guy up for stealing $110. Why don't you give him $1,000 and tell him to go out and have a good time? Because if you lock this guy up in prison, it's going to cost $50,000 a year every year, year after year after year after year, until this guy dies, which is going to consume over $2 million. Why in the hell do we want to spend $2 million over a $100 bike? That doesn't make any kind of economic sense. Now, it makes great economic sense for prison guards. Hell, if I was a prison guard, I'd vote for three strikes and you're out. Hey, it makes a lot of sense for prosecutors, aspiring new lawyers that want to get into the lawyer business by joining the public defender's office and construction companies that are engaged in building prisons. In fact, whole communities bid on these prisons. In fact, down in Utah, there was, they wanted to build a new prison there in Utah, and they came up with about four or five cities. And these cities were offering free land, and they were offering all kinds of incentives and benefits. I mean, they were bidding. They were wooing. They were trying to get the state legislature to put that prison in our community because we want those payrolls. We want that business right here, which is exactly what I told you. It's a business. Crime and punishment is a business, big business. I'll show you how big this business is. There's 2 million prisoners in America today. Let me get 2 million on my calculator here. Times 50,000. Oh, my God. And here's my sharp EL1197G3 calculator. It goes into E, error, zero. It's a number so big, it won't even print out on the screen. So here's what we got to do. Instead of putting in 2 million, we'll just put in 2,000 times 50. Now that's 100,000. Now let's add six zeros. 100, 000, 000. 369, that's $100 billion. $100 billion a year. How do you like that? If you're spending $50,000, now it doesn't cost $50,000 for all 2 million prisoners in jail. That'd be an overstatement. When we lock them up in Vacaville, California, it costs $50,000 a year. When you lock them up in the county jail, it doesn't cost that. And I don't know exactly what it costs in all the county jails. And I can't tell you how many county jails have prisoners in them and what their prices are, as opposed to how many state prisons or how many federal prisons have prisons. I don't have all those numbers in front of me. The last time I saw a number, though, we're spending about $50 billion, about half that 100 there, about $50 billion a year, or about $25,000 per prisoner per year here in the United States. That's the average. So my $50,000 number isn't the average. That's the price of federal and state prison. Counties and city jails cost less than that, and probably most of these guys are in jail for 30, 60, 90 days for drunk driving or something on that order. But here's the moral to the story. Every one of those guys is worth money. Let's take drunk driving. I'll give you another quick example. Let me put a little cross here, a little X, so I don't lose my place here, Mr. Dershowitz. I want to finish your story. Let's take drunk driving. You know, there was a time when I was a kid, drunk driving wasn't against the law. Now, if a drunk driver had an accident and he caused damage, we expected him to pay for it. And if a sober driver had an accident, we expected him to pay for it. But somebody came along one day, and the story that I got was it was some lady's daughter was killed by a drunk driver. And so she went out and created an organization called Mad Drivers Against, or Mad Mothers Against Drunk Drivers. Is it called MADD? Mad Mothers? Is it MMDD? Something like that. Anyways, Mad Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, or something on that order. I don't know if that's true or false. It may be, it may not be, but it was something along that line. And so what we want to do is we want to get all the drunk drivers off the highways. So listen to this story. Now, here's a real life story. There's a guy down in New Mexico. He's a farmer driving an old pickup, and he's drunk, bombed out of his mind, driving home. And there's a doctor with his wife and two young daughters. I think one is 11 and 13, as I recall, the ages, 11, 13 daughters. And the doctor and his wife and two daughters are on their way to Disney World in Florida. They're driving from Los Angeles, California, all the way to Florida to go to Disney World. God, what a vacation, huh? And the doctor and his wife are just happy as clams, and their children are just happy, and they're driving down the road. And wouldn't you know it, here comes this drunk driving farmer, and yeah, you know the story. There's a head-on crash with this drunk driving farmer, and wouldn't you know it, the farmer survives, but the doctor, his wife, and two little girls are killed in this god-awful, they call them alcohol-related accidents. Doesn't that just jerk at your heartstring? All right, now, the farmer, thank God for law and order and justice. The farmer was convicted for drunk driving and sentenced to 10 years in prison for involuntary manslaughter. All right, now, here's what caused the accident. The doctor, fatigued, fell asleep at the wheel and crossed the center line and hit the farmer head on his side of the road. Was it the drunk farmer who caused the accident? No. What was the cause of the accident? The doctor, who was overly fatigued and fell asleep at the wheel. And he was sober, stone cold sober. Nobody complained about his drunk driving. So I just wanted to point out, boys and girls, that there was a time in America when we used more reason, logic, and common sense in dealing with drunk drivers. Now, it would seem like to me that a sober driver who causes an accident should pay for it. And a drunk driver who causes an accident should pay for it. And in the Bible, there's a solution to a drunk driver. Now, in the case that I just related to you, if we use the Mosaic Law and the biblical sense of justice, the biblical justice system, the farmer would sue the estate of the doctor, and the doctor would have to pay the farmer for his damages because the farmer didn't cause any damage. He was a victim. But he was drunk. There's no law in the law of God against drunk driving, nor does there have to be. Hell, maybe the farmer wasn't wearing his seatbelt and didn't have a driver's license. So what? The farmer didn't cause any damage. Let's wake up. The doctor with a license and insurance caused all of the damage and needs to pay for it. And that's what the law of God calls for. Now, of course, that kind of justice is totally intolerable. We've got our own system of justice, so we lock the farmer up in jail. But that costs us about $50,000 a year to lock this farmer up in prison for 10 years. And he didn't do anything. Well, he was driving drunk. And here's what makes it a crime. We decided that driving drunk is a crime. Who wanted the drunk driving statute? The insurance industry wants the drunk driving statute. And the lady whose kid was killed by a drunk driver, she wanted the statute. And she got it. The legislature said, hey, let's give them the statute. And legislatures can make laws. But you know, God told you not to make laws. Did you know that? It's in Deuteronomy 4, verse 2, and Deuteronomy 12, verse 32. He told you not to add to this law. Do not add to my law. Do not take away one jot or tittle from it. As Jesus said that in Matthew 5, 17. He said, not one jot or tittle shall fail from the law until all be fulfilled. So I just thought I'd point that out, the little difference over here. Now, we've tested three strikes and you're out, and it doesn't work. It costs a lot of money. Well, it doesn't work for Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. God, it works for construction companies, prison guards, prosecutors, and the law enforcement growth industry. And the drunk driving statute? No, it hasn't helped you any when it comes to drunk driving fatalities. Or if it has, it's very marginal. It sure as hell hasn't eliminated drunk drivers. But listen, it has created a $2 billion a year drunk driving defense industry. It has been a god-awful boon to the legal profession. Not worth $2 billion a year. And see if I can plug $2 billion into my computer here. I can. 369, yeah. $2 billion. Divided by, and guess what? There's only 50,000 lawyers. 50,000 lawyers. 50,000 lawyers in America that deal in drunk driving or related type law. And see, Alan Dershowitz doesn't deal in that kind of law, so he doesn't make anything off of it. But of those lawyers who do deal in criminal defenses, 50,000 out of 600,000 make $40,000 a year. So the drunk driving statute makes $40,000 a year for 50,000 lawyers who will all be voting for, lobbying for, and doing everything they can to get more drunk driving legislation enacted. Which is precisely what Alan Dershowitz is saying, hey, listen, this is an abuse that needs to be corrected. I just wanted to bring it to your attention. Now, the problem with this approach is that old criminals, even three times losers, are for the most part less violent than the younger ones. The high violence age range tends to be between the middle teen years and the middle 30s. That does not mean, of course, that there are no 50-year-old violent criminals. It does mean, however, that the crime curve drops sharply by the middle 30s, and that any system of mandatory life terms will necessarily include a great many prisoners who would be less violent than their younger counterparts. Another reason why three strikes and you're out will increase crime is that jurors will be less likely to convict three-time losers when they learn, as they inevitably will, that a guilty verdict will mean an automatic life sentence. Already, there is evidence that jurors allow sentencing considerations to enter into their verdicts, even though they're not supposed to. Now, when the word gets out that a guilty verdict may mean life in prison, we will see more Menendez-type hung juries and Bobbitt-type acquittals. Three strikes and you're out will also distort our already confused plea bargaining system by giving two-time losers no choice but to go to trial, thereby increasing the chances of acquittals or hung juries for the most dangerous offenders. And finally, if the net is cast widely enough, as these proposed laws provide, it will catch thousands of relatively minor three-time losers who have been convicted of widely separated borderline crimes. This has been the experience with most multiple offender sentencing statutes that have been tried unsuccessfully by several states over the past 50 years. And that's why most professional criminologists, conservatives, liberals, and non-ideologues are against mandatory life sentences for three or even four-time offenders. Three strikes and you're out is only the most recent manifestation of an approach that has confounded any possibility of realistic solutions to our serious crime problem. That approach focuses on punishments at the extremes. Now, while we debate the death penalty and mandatory life in prison, we neglect the reality that most vicious killers serve less than 10 years in prison, and many armed robbers receive probation. And it's also ironic that at a time when the public is demanding extreme sentences, many also seem willing to excuse killers and maimers who claim that they were abused. And we are both too hard and too soft on criminals. And that's a symptom of the irrationality of our attitudes toward crime. If we are to reduce crime, we must stop sloganeering and start thinking. What is needed are realistic sentences that reflect both the seriousness of the crime for which the defendant has been convicted and a scientific assessment of the nature and likelihood of his repeat offense or recidivism. Now, that's Alan Dershowitz's take on it. I agree. I think he's exactly right. But I think that we can solve that problem and do it more effectively and realistically and do it a whole lot cheaper by going back to the Ten Commandments, which is the program that we had in this country between 1787 and about 1950, round numbers. We used to teach the Ten Commandments in our public schools to our school children. We taught them in our homes and in our churches. We didn't discourage prayer at high school football games, or indeed prayer in school. And I'm sure that Mr. Dershowitz would take exception to that and say, yeah, but now you see, America has invited all of these other religions in, and I'm a Jew, and I'm offended by this Christian crap. And I don't like it and don't want it. But you see, the results that we got from it was more morality. And the solution to crime really resides in morality. Crime is a moral issue, and it requires moral people. It isn't a religious issue. You know, people that are Muslims have a very low crime rate. It is true that Muslims commit crimes, and some of them are pretty damn heinous. But as a general rule, those people don't practice adultery and fornication and robbery and theft and car theft and murder. And they just don't do that. And that's because they have a moral ethic. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not kill. Most religious people, no matter what their religion, have some kind of a moral ethic. Our problem is that we have divorced our public schools totally from any kind of morals. We would not allow a Muslim prayer in a public school. We would not allow a Muslim to come in and say, you know, we don't think that killing people is very good or that stealing, and we would be just offended to no end. And so the ultimate end of it is we have no moral training in our public schools, period. It's totally amoral or amoral. And so as a result, we have young people that come out violent, smoking dope. Rape, robbery, and pillage is common in our public schools. In fact, I've reported to you a number of times that things, you know, like gang violence and rape and shootings in public school, which have now become common. I mean, if you listen to the news tonight and there's a school shooting and 3 or 5 or 11 children are shot, you're not going to be shocked or outraged. Hell, that's common. That goes on every day. It doesn't happen in Catholic school where they teach morality, but it does happen in public school. It doesn't happen in Baptist school or Lutheran school or military schools where they teach morality and discipline, but it does happen in public school. And as long as we continue down this path of ignoring the Ten Commandments and ignoring our Creator, we are going to have crime. And boy, is that crime going to be profitable to those that are promoting crime, such as three strikes and you're out. Remember, it's Alan Dershowitz, and it's called The Abuse Excuse. Hey, I'm out of time again, kids. We're going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Remember that the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Hey, time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.